Listen to WGN Radio's newest podcast, Behind the Badge, Illinois, hosted by David Hochberg. Behind the Badge, Illinois views current events through the eyes of Illinois law enforcement leaders. Tune in. Visit WGNradio.com/behindthebadge.
I'm doing great, John. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you for your time. I'm just looking at my producer-engineer here to make sure that the levels are good. Why don't you count to...
1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6.
Okay, I think we're good to go, right, Aleph? Are the levels all right? You know, this reminds me of when you guys had Monica wearing the wire, and all of a sudden it cut out, and you thought, oh, my God, I hope this thing is recording. And when the agents then go to sit in the booth next to her and Linda Tripp, I thought, did they have to grab somebody and throw them out, or was that table just conveniently available next to them for them to eavesdrop on that conversation?
I chose not to ask that question. You would be a great lawyer, John.
Well, here's what I've done. I just got the book yesterday, and I'm on page 200. And I was just telling my producer,
great.
This reminds me a little bit of Higher Loyalty in that these are books that are very much of the moment and are written by the key players. They're not super long. They are very much about the topic at hand. And you don't get to Monica Lewinsky and Linda Tripp until two-thirds of the way into your book, the same way Comey did not mention Hillary Clinton until two-thirds of the way through his book. That's not where the story starts, is it?
No, that's deep into the tale.
Yeah. Well, we are rolling, so let's just continue.
Okay.
So the book is called Contempt, a Memoir of the Clinton Investigation. Why that title, by the way? Who's contemptuous of whom?
It has to do, first and foremost, with the fact that President Clinton is the only president in our history to have been held in contempt by a federal district court, and Clinton did not appeal that determination. That is a final judgment, and so may it be the only time in American history that that happened. But then more broadly, throughout the investigation, my view, my opinion is both Bill and Hillary showed contempt for the rule of law.
Funny, though, because when we think about Bill Clinton, we think about the fact that he's not the only president to have been impeached, and he was not convicted of those charges. You'd think impeachment is the word that hangs over Bill Clinton. What was he found guilty of contempt?
Yes, his contempt was his conduct, including perjury, in the civil deposition in the Paula Corbin Jones federal civil rights case, a deposition that was presided over by Chief Judge Susan Weber Wright, a very respected federal judge. And because of his conduct, his perjury, his obstruction of justice in that civil deposition held at his own lawyer's office with the federal judge presiding, he was held in contempt.
And is that a big deal? That's not a criminal charge, is it?
No, it was not a criminal charge. It was a civil contempt, and it is a big deal. It's a big deal for anyone, especially a lawyer, but especially a lawyer who is the president of the United States. And in the context of federal civil litigation, when he is a witness sworn to tell the truth.
Here's a couple of things that surprised me, and that is, I always thought that the reason that we knew about Monica Lewinsky and the subsequent lies that tarnished Bill Clinton's presidency were directly connected to the Whitewater investigation. But as I read this, while you all were looking at the McDougals and prosecuting that case, the Paula Jones case appear separate from that. Even if there was no Whitewater investigation, Paula Jones still would have had a charge against the president. Linda Tripp and Monica Lewinsky would have surfaced. So the two aren't necessarily intertwined, are they?
They are not. The sole connection is that Linda Tripp served as executive assistant to Vincent Foster Jr., and Vince Foster famously and tragically took his own life, and the death investigation was part and parcel of what we did during the Whitewater Little Rock phase of the investigation. So that connection, Linda Tripp to Vince Foster, and then later to the Monica Lewinsky phase, is one of those happenstances of history, but you're exactly right. The proceeding would have unfolded whether we would have been called upon to do the investigation or not is quite another thing. But I do describe the drama when Linda Tripp calls our office on a Sunday evening, and when she says, you know, the president is urging this friend of mine to file a perjurious affidavit and so forth. Into the conversation with my colleague, a great prosecutor, Jack Bennett, Linda then says, "You know me, and you know me from the Vince Foster phase of the investigation." So, yeah, that's the connection, but it would have happened anyway. You're so right.
But it might not have been you. I mean, you would not have been looking into that. You guys were working on this real estate deal and the $825,000 that was misused. Somebody else probably would have investigated this civil case with Monica Lewinsky and the rest of them, right?
That's exactly right. But it would have, had it come to light, and we have to assume that it would have come to light, it would have been investigated, and that we know because it was, as I recount in the book, it was Bill Clinton's Attorney General, Janet Reno, who looked at the information we had received from Linda Tripp, including the Linda Tripp tape recordings, and she made the decision, this must be investigated, and Starr is the one to do it.
And just let's make clear why then it was that you were involved in the Linda Tripp, Paula Jones, Monica Lewinsky affair. Linda Tripp was an executive assistant to Vince Foster. There was questions about whether or not he'd committed suicide. You looked into that and confirmed that he had committed suicide. She was the executive assistant. So you all had, in your due diligence, at least gone down that path and found that he took his own life. But now you know who Linda Tripp is. What was Linda Tripp's connection to Monica Lewinsky?
Monica Lewinsky was reassigned from the White House, where she had initially served as an intern, across the Potomac River to the Pentagon in the Public Affairs Office. And there, working at the Public Affairs Office, was Linda Tripp. The two of them became close friends. Then Monica, of course, had become involved romantically with the President of the United States. And Monica was sharing these stories, not just with Linda Tripp, but eight or nine other people became aware of the nature of the relationship between Monica Lewinsky and the president. Then, in the final phase of their friendship, Monica, having filed a perjured affidavit denying that she had any such relationship with the President of the United States, and all that was in the Paula Corbin Jones civil litigation, Monica was urging Linda to likewise file a perjurious affidavit, to lie under oath, to confirm Monica's story. And Linda, doubtless with mixed motives, because she started cooperating unbeknownst to us before we were reintroduced to her.
She was recording these conversations,
Linda Tripp,
yeah.
It was then cooperating with Paula Corbin Jones. We were behind the veil of ignorance on that one. But she came then to us saying, I don't want to file. I don't want to commit perjury. Monica basically already has, and now she wants me to do the same thing, and I'm just not going to do it. Don't want to do it.
Monica Lewinsky was so young. It's amazing how reckless Bill Clinton was, right? I mean, it's remarkable that he was able to carry on an affair and to think that she would not tell anybody. She was telling a lot of people. This was destined to become public, wasn't it?
Yes. It was rash and foolhardy, the classic self-inflicted wound from his failure to control himself. So, yes, at the time, she was in her early 20s, obviously starstruck. But I'll tell you one thing. As I describe in the book, Monica Lewinsky is extremely intelligent and has one of the most phenomenal memories that I have run into. She was able to reconstruct their various, and there were a number of them, including phone calls and the like over the period of many, many months. She had a prodigious memory, but here I think is what's so important that I tried to explain in the book. She was determined to protect the president. She did not want the fact of her relationship with him, which she chose not to keep secret, so she shouldn't have done that. if she really wanted to protect him. That was unwise on her part. But anyway, she then, once things turned sour, so to speak, she was bound and determined to protect the president. And she was very clever and manipulative, effectively, at keeping us at bay, keeping us, being the independent counsel's office, at bay, while the president then proceeded to mount a pretty aggressive offense that resulted, as I describe in the book, in what we viewed, and I say this in the Star report or the referral to the House of Representatives, an abuse of presidential power.
And yet, talk about saving the president. The president could have saved himself if, when Paula Jones, I mean, she's really the first domino here. Paula Jones said, look, the president has harassed me. He's come on to me. There's an article in the American Spectator that mentions Paula. I'm afraid people will find out about it. She goes after the president in civil court. She wants $175,000 for each incident, for $500,000 or so, and an apology. He could have gotten off with this, but he didn't. Maybe Hillary wouldn't allow it. And so now they're investigating the charge, and they hear about a Monica Lewinsky, and so now we have this thing rolling. Am I recollecting that correctly, that inevitably led to
exactly right. It was another self-inflicted wound by Bill Clinton, this enormously talented, charismatic person who then not only used bad judgment in terms of entering into the relationship with Monica, but then once this became known, not just putting it behind him and saying, okay, I fouled up, so let's get this resolved. Let's settle the case. Instead, and that included, as I describe in the book, two of his own justices, two justices who he appointed, agreed with the unanimous, but they were part of the unanimous court.
This is an issue that we're dealing with these days when we talk about crimes that the current president may or may not have committed or be committing. So is it your view then that the current president should be held accountable for crimes that he's committing while he was in office or before he was in office? Should he be held responsible for
Yes.
As a sitting president, he should be able to prosecute.
I do believe that that is the better view, but obviously it's not the only view. Not only is it not the only view, my view in terms of the accountability of the president is not held by the Department of Justice, and that's been the case for now several decades. It's not just the Department of Justice under President Trump. That is the policy. That is the determination, namely, a sitting president cannot be indicted.
Says the Justice Department. Is that settled law, though? I mean, do we know what, in fact, the court would say about this?
We don't. We only have the Justice Department's view. It's a view that's very well expressed, articulated in a formal legal opinion. But no, we do not have a resolution by any court, much less the Supreme Court of the United States. And Clinton versus Jones, involving Paula Corbin Jones, as we've been discussing, points, in my view, exactly in the opposite direction. The president is not above the law, including the criminal law.
Speaking of issues that we're dealing with today, based very much on what you all had to do when you were investigating Clinton and the McDougals in the Whitewater case, how do you feel about flipping? That is, prosecuting somebody, getting a conviction, and then maybe holding out that the sentence will be less if they cooperate in another investigation going after a bigger fish. The president feels this is what may be happening to him.
It sounds awful, but it is a traditional, time-honored tool in the prosecutor's toolbox. That's simply the way the operation works. Think about organized crime. Think of La Cosa Nostra. How do you get to the top of the hierarchy of an organized crime organization? And that is the time-tested and honored way of doing it. But what is there anything unjust about it? I don't think so. It sounds worse than it in fact is. As long as there's righteousness in the prosecution and the guilty plea of those who are lower on the proverbial food chain. Now, if there is undue pressure, that is, if you don't plead guilty, I'm going to come after your wife, your children, your dog, then I think that kind of approach constitutes prosecutorial abuse, is excessive, and is wrong.
What about pardoning or holding out pardons to potential witnesses. Bill Clinton murmured that to some of these people, and we know that Donald Trump floats that idea. What do you think about that?
I think that is an abuse of power. We felt, again, that President Clinton had abused power in a number of respects. I believe that was one way in which he abused presidential power. But that is not a crime. Unless he is being paid, right, a bribe to conduct a pardon or to issue a pardon, then he has the power to do it, but his exercise of power may constitute an abuse of that power and might very well constitute an impeachable offense.
Another parallel between the two presidencies, if you will, is how long it takes to investigate a case like this. I've interviewed a congressman from Northwest Indiana a few weeks ago, and he said that it's time for Mueller to show his cards. This has dragged on too long. What is your comment about the length of these proceedings?
Unless there is reason to believe, and Rod Rosenstein, the deputy attorney general who appointed Bob Mueller, concludes that they're delaying, they're stalling, or whatever, there's no reason for us to believe that Bob Mueller and his team are not doing their job. There's no reason. We don't know. And every now and then, Mueller will do something, such as his indictments earlier this year of the Russian individuals and the Russian organization. Those indictments are extremely powerful. They don't point in the slightest to collusion with the campaign, much less any involvement by then-candidate Donald Trump. They do point to exactly what it was Bob Mueller was appointed to do, which is, was there connection, coordination between the Russians and so forth? Well, he needs to go look at what was Russia doing, right? What were Russian activities? And that's pretty complicated stuff. He's returned those indictments. We all know about the Paul Manafort indictment and so forth. So we just don't know what Bob Mueller and the team knows and how complicated it is to get evidence and so forth. So unless there is an oversight hearing with Rod Rosenstein being called to account, why is the Bob Mueller investigation taking so long? Then we just don't know. And it's hard. I think it's impossible to issue a fair judgment.
Well, this has gone on for 18 months or less. How long did the Clinton investigation take?
We went on for 5 years.
Yeah. Can you imagine?
Now, that having been said, it's a little bit of apples and oranges here because we had add-ons, right? We had the travel office add-ons I describe in the book, the FBI files investigation. So we were given additional assignments as we went along, and we don't know whether Bob Mueller is getting additional assignments or not. So I did not simply have the original Whitewater case, and as I also describe in contempt, when I arrived in Little Rock, and I will always remember that day in August of 1994, I thought it was just a failed land deal in Arkansas. I'd be through in 6 months. But I inherited the investigation that had already begun into Whitewater, and the wonderful lawyer, Bob Fisk, who Attorney General Janet Reno had appointed to begin that investigation, said, and I describe this in the book, Ken, move your family to Little Rock. You're going to be here for a long time. So that was the original investigation. Then you do the add-ons, and of course, ultimately, the Monica Lewinsky phase and the last phase of the investigation. So it added up.
Maybe, Ken Starr, you have some insight into this, too. The president often describes the angry Democrats on Mueller's team that are working against him, though Mueller is a Republican and he's a Republican. What do you make of the political affiliation of the IRS, FBI agents, and the Department of Justice people relative to your investigation and the current investigation?
I think that the concerns are very well founded about the open partisanship of many of the lawyers on Bob Mueller's team. I was surprised about that. I was disappointed about that. And so to go back to my situation, as I explain in the book, I was being accused almost from the very beginning of being a partisan Republican, not a former judge and so forth. I was and still am a law guy, not a political guy. But that was the beef. That was the attack. So I said, okay, if that's the attack, public confidence in the honest administration of justice is very important. So I went out and engaged in an outreach to find qualified Democrats I didn't want them to do anything other than check their politics at the door and do the most professional, honest, and honorable job that they could. But the person who ran the D.C. office was a very active Democrat who had supported Bill Clinton in the 92 election. I then brought on a special ethics counselor, very well-known Democrat, Sam Dash, who had been a very key part of the Watergate investigation back in the 1970s as chief counsel to the Democrat-controlled Senate Select Committee on Watergate. So I took those actions for the very reason of wanting to promote the appearance of justice. So it doesn't surprise me that Bob Mueller, a Republican, has Democrats on his team. He's a Republican investigating a Republican. But these Democrats were so active in the campaign and the emails and so forth that were sent. I just find it very troubling. So I hope and pray that Bob Mueller is genuinely in charge and is just taking every step that he possibly can to ensure that there is an honest investigation as opposed to a politically driven investigation.
I wonder if he'll be able to sell that anyway. I mean, you know what it's like these days, both the optics of this and the allegiance that the president has, both with his core and with members of Congress. I suppose he could come out with some damning charges and still have trouble selling them.
It may be a self-inflicted challenge that he will have to overcome. But again, I have great confidence in Bob Mueller's integrity, and so he's just going to have to, of course, master the facts, master the law, and I have every confidence that he can do that, and I hope that he will, so that we have an honest judgment that whatever it is, whether it's pro or con the president, that people said, well, it was honest. I don't like the fact that there were people around him who were so partisan and political. The same thing, by the way, was said about Leon Jaworski, before him Archibald Cox, by the Nixon White House, that they're all a bunch of partisan Democrats trying to get him. Well, they may be partisan Democrats, but the key is, can you check your politics at the door, just like we asked judges, federal judges? You're entering the monastery now. You cannot now view the world through the political lens, even though you may have been a candidate, you may have been politically involved and so forth. You just have to set all that aside. Put that in the rearview mirror. Don't look back. You've got a different job to do. And prosecutors have a very similar kind of dynamic that they've got to overcome. Their partisan leaning, the way they think as citizens, cannot guide the way or shape the way they think as prosecutors.
My last question is, and I know that you waited a long time to tell this story. This book didn't come out on the heels of the investigation. It's 2018, for crying out loud. And the timing, as it turns out, is most fortuitous. And yet, with all of this time lapsed, I'm amazed at how chatty or gossipy or juicy the book is not. When you describe how Hillary Clinton is in 1995 being deposed, and she's there in the White House, and she's, or was it the residence, and she's very stern, very quiet. She's saying, no comment, I don't remember. And that just seems utterly bogus. Bill Clinton had just preceded her for a 3-hour interview, and he's chatty, and he's talking about things they did as kids and what music do you like. Bill Clinton leaves, and then there's this stone face, icy, dismissive Hillary Clinton. As they are interviewing her, an aide comes in, whispers to somebody, somebody whispers to somebody. You can tell that Hillary is ticked. What's going on? And then the aide reaches into the closet and pulls out Bill's golf clubs. And off he goes golfing while Hillary is putting up with this. There must have been 1,000 opportunities for you to give us a glimpse at their lives and personalities. And it must have been tempting to do more of that, Ken.
It was. I wanted to give in the book a flavor of the life of what went on, and not just here's the law, here are the facts, and so forth. But I thought that was a very helpful vignette in understanding the personalities of these two individuals who, I believe, committed wrongdoing in Arkansas. We drew up, and I describe this in the book, we drew up a very elaborate indictment of Hillary Rodham Clinton, and it was supported by a very detailed prosecution memo, what we call in the trade a pros memo. But in the end, we determined we simply did not have the evidence, the admissible evidence that would stand up in court and would prove beyond a reasonable doubt that she had committed crimes in her work with the Rose Law Firm representing the fraud-infected Madison Guaranty Savings and Loan, the stealing of the Rose Law Firm records, which I go into some detail.
Yeah.
How did Rose Law Firm billing records find their way? Having been stolen, there's no question they were improperly removed from the law office in those pre-electronic record days from the law offices in Little Rock, and then found their way into the book room where Hillary was writing a book in the residence of the White House. I mean, just the circumstantial evidence is very strong, but we eventually made the professional judgment. We just don't have the evidence. So we wanted to just lay all this out, but also tell a few stories along the way that showed the humanity. These are human beings and how they act under these very different circumstances.
That said, is there anything else you want to add? That is, we've waited this long to tell this story. What else do you want the American people to know? What myths do we still harbor? What misconceptions do we still have? What's the big takeaway from your vantage point?
One of the biggest takeaways is impeachment is hell. I believe that there could have been a different resolution of the William Jefferson Clinton matter through a resolution of censure, and I discussed that at some length. That had been discussed, encouraged by various members of the president's own party, Senator Dianne Feinstein of California then, as now, was bringing her judgment to bear, and she said that, well, I don't think this is rises to the level of impeachment. Then the impeachment itself, the process itself, was so rancor-filled. And even though 31 Democrats voted in favor of, in the House of Representatives, voted in favor of one or more articles, the American people loathe the idea of impeachment. You always hear voices in favor of impeachment. You're hearing them now. One of those similarities, one of those echoes from the past. And I think a lesson in this book, a lesson that the American people have taught us is don't go there. There should be viewed a very powerful, bright yellow warning light, caution light. Be very careful. We want stability in this country. We have elections. We're about to have a midterm election. Let's go through that process. Let's don't keep talking about impeachment. That's a lesson that I drew and I try to articulate in the book.
You don't think there's evidence in the public domain right now that the president has obstructed justice?
No, I do not, because I have a very different view of obstruction of justice than some of the people who I hear in the media. I believe that the president of the United States can fire James Comey, can take other actions, can issue pardons and so forth in the exercise of his power. If Congress views that kind of activity as an abuse of his power, then he can be called to the bar of justice, as it were, in impeachment. But I just think there's no crime, as I see it, in light of the nature, as I see it, of presidential power. But an abuse of that power is not a crime. Don't go to the courthouse. But if the American people feel strongly enough about it, that we have a president who's abusing power, I haven't seen it. That's what impeachment is, in fact, for. But again, I want to reiterate that I think the Clinton saga tells us, including his abuse of power, such as his improper invocation of the doctrine of executive privilege, his invention of a completely phantom doctrine to keep Secret Service agents from testifying, his using other mechanisms and levers of power, getting Monica a job, paying hush money to, as I see it, to Webster Hubbell, another one of the witnesses in the campaign, in the entire investigation. All those things added together simply did not persuade the House of Representatives that there had been an abuse of power. So I think it's going to be it's going to be a daunting challenge for those, especially now the cries from the left, impeach, let's have an election, then as soon as if the Democrats take control of the House, let's bring on the articles of impeachment. I think that is quite dangerous, and it simply is going to further divide the American people.
I don't know if we'll hear the chant again, when Clinton lied, no one died. That was used against George Bush, but I wonder if it is a measure of scale, that is, Clinton's sins were self-inflicted, they were sexual, it was a real estate deal involving $825,000. I mean, really, except that they were wrong, what's the harm here, as opposed to what's being lobbed against the current president, which is the very foundation of our democracy, the integrity of the elections.
But I do think that, and that's one way of looking at it, but I think that that characterization, and it is a popular characterization, is terribly incomplete. It fails to consider that which we've been talking about, namely the abuse of power, and then just the seriousness of lying under oath, encouraging others to lie, obstructing justice, and otherwise, a president of the United States who's contemptuous of the rule of law.
And lastly, you do have confidence in Rob Rosenstein. He actually was on your team in the Whitewater investigation and now is obviously a pivotal player in whatever will happen to Donald Trump. You have confidence in him, correct?
I do. Rod Rosenstein, as I describe in the book, was a key member of our trial team in the trial, the successful trial against James and Susan McDougal, who co-won the Madison Guaranteed Savings and Loan in Little Rock, and then the sitting governor at the time, Jim Guy Tucker. He was a stand-up guy, total integrity, and has been an absolutely admirable public servant for now these 20 years, 20-plus years, as a very distinguished United States attorney in the District of Maryland, appointed by a Republican, retained by a Democratic president, and so forth. Rod Rosenstein is the real thing. He's a pearl. He has absolute rock-ribbed integrity. Does that mean he's done everything right? That I don't know. I just know him to be a person of complete honor and integrity.
Read Ken Starr's Contempt, a memoir of the Clinton investigation, and if you're like me, you will come away with, if nothing else, a good feeling about justice in this country and how it works. And it's a nicer and a fuller sort of impression of you, Ken. I've so enjoyed the book and very much enjoyed your time with us today.
Thank you very much. It was a great privilege and pleasure.